Greetings, this is Sean Poole with Science Progress. Today we're listening in on a conversation with Andrew Light, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Paul Greenberg, a lifelong angler and author of the new book, For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Greenberg has also written Leaving Katya, a novel, and has written for the New York Times Magazine, Book Review, and Opinion Page, as well as for National Geographic and GQ. The new book, For Fish, examines humanity's relationship with fish, elucidates the crisis that relationship faces today, and advances a vision for what a sustainable future could look like. Let's listen in.
So thank you, Paul, for joining us.
My pleasure.
It seems like more than ever, I mean, this is a clear message of your book, how things have evolved, that humans are relying on fish as a source of protein, and this trend just is increasing.
Yes.
But as we see this trend increasing, it's also exacerbating the deeply troubled relationship we have with this collection of species, in particular the four that you talk about in your book, salmon, cod, tuna, and sea bass. And in that respect, I think that insofar as the first thing that's probably needed is a lot more discussion, at least in terms of policy institutions like CAP and in the halls of Congress, about coming up with a coherent national, international fisheries policy. This book is a very welcome achievement. So maybe we can just kind of start with why you chose these four fish in particular, of the many that you could have talked about.
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is that there are too many fish in the sea to write a whole book about.
Right.
But the other more kind of, I think, profound ecological moment is that when you look back over the history of humanity and animals and the animals that we eat, we seem to have a tendency to simplify things. And, you know, if you go back 10,000 years to when humans first started domesticating mammals, you look in the fire pits of humans from those periods, from that period, and there were all kinds of mammals in the fire pits, muskrat, elk, deer, all these kinds of creatures that we ate. But by the time of Christ, we're kind of down to four, pigs, sheep, goats, and cattle. And the same thing happens with birds, you know, many, many birds out there. And even if you look at restaurant menus from the 18th to 19th century, you'll see snipe and woodcock and all those kinds of things. But now we're down to basically four, chickens, turkeys, ducks, and geese. So it struck me that, you know, as I started to look around fish markets, I started to see these particular four varieties of fish. And I should clarify here that we're not quite talking about species here. We're talking about almost like flesh archetypes. You know, I say salmon is one of the fish, but there actually are, you know,
many different kinds. Right?
Yeah, species of them. And sea bass, it's even worse. I mean, sea bass is actually kind of almost a fake name across the board. I've counted, I think, eight taxonomic families that have fish in them called sea bass. But it still represents a flesh archetype, and there is a specific fish called European sea bass, a specific species that has been domesticated and that more and more is becoming the sort of default sea bass because it's available from domesticated sources. And then, you know, codfish, which is sort of like the commoner's fish, I chose because, again, it's such a market dominator, or it had been for so many years, but then its complete collapse in the 80s and the 90s has led to a whole range of other replacement fish, like tilapia, for example. And then finally, tuna represents that sort of kind of steaky archetype of flesh that is, you know, more and more a part of the American diet. It's interesting, you know, 50 years ago, there wasn't very much tuna outside of a can on the market. But what's happened is the increasingly privatized and nationalized nature of the ocean has caused nations to turn to tuna, which are, in effect, stateless fish that cross international boundaries and, you know, are often outside of regulation or difficult to regulate. I think it's one of the reasons we've seen so much tuna on the market. So that's sort of how I arrived at those four fish. I mean, they're the things that consumers recognize, and I think they're the way in for the lay consumer to kind of understand what's going on with the ocean.
And are there particular, I mean, there seem to be, just from the way you've talked about it, particular unique jurisdictional problems that you have with, say, you know, tuna versus salmon?
Yes.
And was that also part of your sort of approach for selecting these
well,
flesh,
you know,
archetypes that they raise different issues that we can dig into a little deeper?
Yes, definitely. And actually, each flesh archetype kind of represents a different zone of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Salmon, you know, represent the intertidal and, you know, riparian zones of, you know, river systems where salmon literally swam to us. They're the Chinese food of the fish world in that they get delivered right to us, and it's where we had the most serious environmental effects, you know, because we degraded so many rivers and we've degraded so many estuaries. You know, sea bass represent the sort of next step out, coastal areas, and again, not so, you know, salmon and sea bass don't represent a huge jurisdictional area because problem because they tend to be local fish. You know, there's not too much international competition or interstate competition for a given stock of these fish. But then cod do represent maybe the first really huge large-scale problem of multinational fishing treaties trying to figure out how to scientifically, soundly divvy up stocks. And then finally, when you get to tuna, that's, you know, just a mess, particularly with bluefin. You know, they spawn in the Mediterranean, and you have all the nations around the Mediterranean having to figure out a way to divvy up those fish without driving them to extinction. And to date, it really hasn't quite worked.
Right. What do you think about in terms of where we are with the national and the international capacity for regulating fisheries? I mean, it seems like so much of the story is the same that we see with, you know, anything we look at in terms of the broader energy, climate, environmental
world. Change,
they're entrenched interests
that
you know, and they're not people sitting around plotting, you know, wringing their hands with black hats, how can we sort of exploit and drive these things to extinction? It's just, you know, people with boats, that's what they've sort of built their lives around.
Yep.
There certainly are some corporate interests in here and some national interests, like obviously the Japanese have inserted themselves quite strongly in the debates about international regulation of tuna. But what do you think in terms of where we are with the kind of the policy architecture to even begin to thinking about problems like this?
I mean, we're, you know, what we've seen over the last 100 years is a gradual nationalization and privatization of the seas. It used to be that a nation only owned its waters as far as a cannonball would fall. So in other words, that was what marked the border of international waters. You know, that was extended out and has gradually gotten further and further at sea to the point where I think it was the UN Law of the Sea Treaty in 82 established exclusive economic zones for nations out to 200 nautical miles. That actually is an interesting thing because the nationalization of seas initially in a lot of places caused overfishing to occur because suddenly people were like, oh, we got rid of the foreigners and now we can catch all the fish. But now that ramp up has been seen to be imprudent in places like the United States, I think it's actually led to better regulation and more control. But it's also led to, I think, a shifting of fishing pressure from national waters into what's called the high seas, you know, the international waters that lay between exclusive economic zones. And so, in a way, it's a kind of a cat and mouse. Like, people keep regulating and privatizing the sea, and that sort of overcapacity of fishing effort that we built up during the last 50 years, instead of getting just decommissioned and putting into mothballs, just kind of spurts its way around the globe looking for unregulated fisheries. And I think we're still kind of closing the circle. And if we can close the circle before we, say, drive bluefin tuna or other big tuna species to commercial extinction, and we can actually unbuild the international fishing fleet, which is now twice as big, according to the UN, than it needs to be, then there's some hope, I think, for you know, for even some of these straddling stocks.
Right. So, Paul, one of the things that clearly has been dominating the news cycle this summer has been the BP oil spill. And, you know, we're going back and forth with, it seems like every day NPR has got a different story on whether or not it's safe for me to eat, you know, fish coming from the Gulf or not safe, what's the future there, these kinds of things. What can you tell us as an expert in this area about what are some of the long-term consequences of the BP oil spill for the fishing industry and these stocks of fish?
You know, just as not an expert on marketing, but I think that, you know, a lot of what has suffered the most from the spill has been the reputation of Gulf seafood. I think this is going to live in the popular imagination for a long, long time. And already the University of Minnesota found that 31% of Americans said that they were eating less seafood as a result of the spill, even though only 2% of our seafood comes from the Gulf. So right then and there, there's a PR damage. Ecology damages, though, are going to be coming out. You know, what happened and what really was damaged is going to take some time to figure out, but I'm pretty sure we're definitely going to see some very bad effects on bluefin tuna populations. Bluefin spawn only in the Gulf of Mexico in the western part of their range. They also spawn in the Mediterranean. But our American spawned bluefin only spawn in the Gulf. And if you look at Tag of Giants, a great organization that's been documenting bluefin spawning in the Gulf, and if you look at one of the major spawning areas of bluefin, it almost exactly overlays the spill, and the spill happened right as the bluefin were spawning. And the pernicious thing about this is that these fish are going to, you know, there's going to be still going to be adult fish in the water for some years to come, but 7 years down the line when the next generation of bluefin that would have been spawned this year should be maturing, I think we could see a considerable dip in the numbers of fish out there. I'm hoping that's not going to be the case, but I think it could very well be the case.
So what about the human populations that have had to live through these transitions? Either the transitions that just happen as a matter of course because the fish aren't there anymore through mismanagement, or where we've tried a kind of a draconian, you know, step. Well, there's no way to say draconian in a good sense, I guess.
Yeah.
But we've tried, like, you know, an emergency.
Well-intentioned draconian.
Exactly, well-intentioned, you know. In thinking here, the obvious sort of well-known case is the case of regulation of cod in Canada. I was living there when the cod wars sort of erupted between Spain and Canada, and then these sort of very dramatic changes were made to limit fishing around Newfoundland, which had a tremendous impact on the local community there.
Yep.
Visited there sort of shortly thereafter, met out-of-work fishermen, met people who got out, you know, right at the right time. You know, and are we learning some lessons of some better and worse ways to do this? I mean, in the sort of the worst-case scenarios where we realize a too far down the road that we need to make a change?
I mean, the lesson we're learning is we have too many fishermen. And, you know, I don't know if those people in Newfoundland are ever going to get their jobs back. You know, from an ecological standpoint, it's a good thing that those fishermen are out of work. Certainly, it's not a good thing for those fishermen. But the problem with Canada and the Canada cod stocks is that they have a very simple ecosystem up there. It's basically cod eating capelin and nothing very much in between. I mean, they have lobsters and snow crab, which, you know, has been sort of the thing that's filled in for cod in their absence. But you take a look at codfish or codfish grounds, traditional codfish grounds further south, say Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank, it's more complex. There's other species that these guys can potentially chase. You know, they have haddock in very good numbers now in Georges Bank, which actually recovered after these fishing closures. But the rule remains, you know, these big industrial fishing jobs are not going to come back to a lot of these codfish grounds. What is starting to emerge, and this is a positive trend in fishing, are these more small-scale fisheries, like the Cape Cod Hook Fishermen's Association out of Chatham. You know, they are trying to reintroduce hook and line gear. Granted, it's long lining. It's not just, you know, one guy with a pole and a hook. But long lining is generally less damaging to the bottom ecology, you know, than those big trawling boats that ripped up the bottom were. So if we can sort of see that kind of industrial fishing sector replaced with a smaller scale, you know, multi-party, you know, artisanal fishing sector, then I think, you know, that could be a good model for going forward and trying to, you know, shift some of these industrial fishing efforts around the world.
And that sort of strategy in part depends on driving up the price of wild fish that are coming out. So
absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, we have to start looking at wild fish as this, you know, pretty precious commodity. And, you know, we don't want to get to the point where, like, nobody can afford wild fish except for the most wealthy people. But it's more like it should become something that, you know, maybe portions are smaller, maybe it's more treasured on the plate, maybe you don't have it. You know, cod was, you know, New England, cod was, you know, a 3 or 4 kind of a week kind of deal. But, you know, maybe it really can only be a once a week kind of deal. And, you know, and the fish will be better quality as a result of it. I mean, those big industrial factory boats, you know, immediately freeze stuff. It's sort of beaten around in the well of the boat. It's not exactly fine quality flesh. Whereas some of these day boats that fish out of Chatham, you know, they take real care with their fish. They bleed it. They ice it very carefully. The fish themselves look good. There's less gaping when you cook them. So if they can offer a better product, then maybe they deserve to get a higher price for it.
And on the consumer side, this is also would also be the part of, like, the promotion of eating locally and you know, locavore.
That's right.
Which I find a crutch that I rely on maybe too much after reading your book, but, you know, my sort of Monterey Bay card, right, that I carry around religiously in my wallet, sort of the sustainable seafood guide.
Yep.
And there's a companion version for the East Coast that's done out of the Georgia Aquarium.
Yeah. You can also download it on your iPod, and it syncs to whatever your local market is, apparently.
There you go.
Yeah.
but that has to be on the other side. It's sort of the cultivation of that kind of ethos of around eating fish, that it really is the kind of thing that...
You know, if you want to have... you know, a meal that you feel good about, something like a mackerel is a great fish. It's, you know, it's actually in the tuna family. So if you want to get the sort of omega-3s and so forth, it's a good fish because it's very populous. It's resistant to fishing pressure. Sardines are also real good. Shellfish of a variety of nature, you know, Squid are often a very good choice, depending on mixture, you know, depending on the, you know, how they're harvested. But generally, lower on the trophic level is where we want to go with our fishing pressure. But you know, on a larger, you know, policy stance, I mean, I do think people also need to kind of fight the right fight. And you know, going back to this pebble mine thing, I would like to see people get behind stopping pebble mine and ensuring that we have a good supply of wild salmon for the future. And you know, furthermore, you know, I almost feel like, you know, there should be a carbon credit system for eating fish, you know. If you're going to eat fish and continue to eat fish, then I think you need to kind of, you know, should be able to kind of buy a piece of a marine protected area so that you could kind of, you know, keep some of it fallow for the future. I mean, I don't know if this method has been tried, but if it could be applied along scientific bases, it wouldn't be such a bad thing to do. And you have to build capacity. I mean, you know, I was talking with Michael Pollan about this the other day, and you know, the thing is, you know, as the land food reform movement goes on, the real thing that needs to happen on land food is, you know, building capacity for, say, grass-fed beef. There just weren't enough grass-fed producers, but they've, you know, grown considerably, you know, since the food reform movement started. The problem with the fish reform movement is that you actually have to both decrease capacity on the one hand of this industrial fishing effort, but then you have to kind of re-gear and reconfigure this sort of more fish-sensitive sector that can, you know, provide this good product at a low environmental cost.
Right. So the other side of that equation, you mentioned this earlier, of course, is, you know, you want to grow out the kind of the specialized market where you could get a higher price and also contribute to an overall more coordinated sustainability action plan.
Yeah.
The other side, of course, is this burgeoning, growing demand.
That's right.
For seafood, just for base protein needs. So how do we? What's the strategy there? Because clearly, you know, it's not going to be providing a sort of a high price alternative.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is that, you know, per capita fish consumption has nearly doubled in the last 50 years. So, you know, and population has of course increased dramatically. So overall, fish consumption is going to keep going up and up and up. And that's where, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, aquaculture does have a role to play. But, you know, because a lot of aquaculture to date has depended on carnivorous fish like salmon to artificially boost the supply of fish, those fish eat other fish, and so you're ending up with a net protein loss. There are, though, fish out there, like, for example, tilapia, barramundi, a couple other, you know, the Vietnamese pangasius species, that have the potential to be largely vegetarian and produce a net protein marine protein gain for the world. So, you know, I think that we're going to see is a sort of a bifurcation of the market where, you know, wild fish get to be more expensive, maybe more sensitively harvested. And then farmed fish are going to, you know, hopefully if they can be scaled up in a way that is not too egregiously bad to the environment, that they could bear that sort of industrial brunt. Like they can become the fish sticks and the, you know, whatever, the fast food sandwiches. And, you know, the other day I was in a Denny's and literally the only fish on the menu was a tilapia. And tilapia, as you know, it's from Africa. It's entirely farmed. And, you know, that might just be the wave of the future.
Certainly the market will help to drive that sort of bifurcation.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I mean, as far as I do think that, you know, there are very distinct political actions that I think the, you know, invested consumer can do. One thing I've been really pointing out to people lately is a mining project that's on the books in Alaska. It's called Pebble Mine. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge copper and gold mine that they're trying to start at the headwaters of Bristol Bay, which is probably the largest, most productive salmon estuary in the world. You know, there's very, very significant problems with copper mining. And there was a 2 million fish kill in China about 3 weeks ago as a result of a copper mine spill, you know, an effluent spill. We really shouldn't be copper mining in what is really the last redoubt of wild salmon in the world. This isn't small potato salmon. This is the salmon that you see for $4.99 in a can. This is the common people's salmon. Pink salmon often ends up in the can. Sockeye often ends up in the can. So I think, you know, right then and there, if people were to go to, there's a site called Save Bristol Bay, and, you know, there are letters, form letters there that you can send to your congressman to, you know, to stop this mine. I think it's a very significant thing people could do for wild fish. Further down the line, the other thing that's important is that we need to establish more marine protected areas. You know, we protect about 10% of our land area in some kind of manner, but less than 1% of our seas. And if we start to see the economic value of doing things like putting codfish spawning grounds in some degree of protection so that they're not fished during sensitive spawning periods or not fished at all, then I think it's a little bit like kind of opening a fisheries bank account that we can kind of keep for long, you know, that will accrue long-term interest rather than kind of just fishing every square foot of territory that we have.
So in that context, as you know, last month, President Obama signed an executive order establishing a new national policy for the stewardship of the oceans.
Yep.
This came through over a year-long process of
yep.
you know, creating this interagency commission to look into what could be done about a coordinated plan. It's a great step forward.
Mm-hmm.
Big problem is not a lot of funding for
yep.
a lot of these priorities right now.
Yeah. Fish and fisheries are they're the Rodney Dangerfield of conservation. They get neither the respect nor the funding that they need, and you know, which leads to kind of a dangerous scientific environment because you know scientists require stock assessments in order to determine how much fishing can be done and how much habitat restoration needs to happen. But there's really not even the money available to correctly monitor and assess where we are with fish and fisheries. So, you know, it's a tremendously important food system. It's not just the ocean. And I think if we could start to see it as a food system and not just like, you know, sort of the environment, then perhaps maybe it could start to draw in money from, you know, from other agencies. I'm not sure how it's going to work funding-wise, but I'd certainly like to see more money coming down the pike.
So what would your short list of priorities be for the president? Like what?
Yeah, well, you know, marine protected areas, you know,
right.
without a question need to be increased. I think the one thing that's actually kind of often overlooked is the incredible plethora of small-scale dams that are scattered throughout
mm-hmm.
the United States,
mm-hmm.
particularly the East Coast. Those small-scale dams are depressing the numbers of things like river herring that are keystone species and forage species for most of the fish that we like to eat. And if we were to go through a national project of removing all of those small-scale dams, I think we'd see a considerable uptick in both prey and predators, which would lead to a more, you know, healthy ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lastly, I don't think aquaculture should be left out of the mix, but I don't think the current path that they're pursuing is a good one. You know, there's been on the books this discussion called sort of creepily titled the National Offshore Aquaculture Act, you know,
mm-hmm.
which the acronym is NOAA. You know, it's like, why are we calling it that? But anyway, the proposal was basically because many states don't want to have aquaculture in their waters, they're trying to kind of go around the process by opening up federal waters, which go from 300 to 200 miles offshore. It's a process that keeps getting stalled. People don't like it. I think it's kind of beating a dead horse. And I'd rather see money go into really focusing on recirculating aquaculture systems that try and perfect the technology to keep farmed fish separate from wild fish. You know, there's a guy in Baltimore called Jonathan Zohar who's, you know, got this fully operational sort of mini fish farm in downtown Baltimore. You know, it's not scaled up to size. We don't know if these kind of scalable things will work, I mean, when they're scaled up to size. But if we're going to invest in aquaculture research, I do think that that's, you know, an important way of the future.
That's really the most important issue is just how do you sort of get better barriers between
yes,
the
exactly.
open wild stocks, which seems to me incredibly important since we're so close to approving the first genetically modified salmon.
I know. Well, you know, it's crazy, right, that on the one hand you have Pebble Mine, which could potentially wipe out a run of 100 million pounds of salmon a year, and on the other hand we're about to approve in the FDA a genetically modified salmon that probably in the end result 100 million pounds more of salmon. You know, so like what do, you know, I think these two people, these two agencies, whoever's in charge of these two separate things needs to get together and say, huh? You know, why are we doing a genetically modified salmon when we're, and at the same time risking our wild salmon? We need to kind of figure that out. But the separation of wild and farmed is extremely important, as you say. With wild salmon, and with this genetically modified salmon, you know, they're talking about growing it in recirculating systems, which is all well and good, except that I think that there's a good chance that that technology is going to escape American borders and be employed in countries which don't have the biosecurity regulations that we have. And then, of course, the other very clear example of the need to separate wild and farmed is if you look at two keystones, you know, key commercial species, Atlantic salmon have been farmed in proximity to wild Atlantic salmon in the States and Canada, you know, for about 20, 30 years, and we've seen only declines in wild salmon. Striped bass, on the other hand, which were severely depressed in the early 80s, farm striped bass are grown in ponds and raceways. They're a hybrid fish that can't interbreed with the wild fish. So there's the natural, both a biological and a physical separation. And what we've seen is now farm striped bass make up 60% of the market, and wild striped bass have recovered nicely. So why don't we take that as our model moving forward?
And something where we're really looking at an adaptive management sort of philosophy to this.
Exactly. And I guess, you know, the other thing is, I think, you know, aquaculture and fisheries are often seen as like two very separate things. But we're ultimately trying to come up with a seafood supply for our country. And I think whoever's looking at the seafood supply has to kind of think about what is aquaculture's contribution, because it just continues to grow. I mean, I'm a fisherman. I like to fish. I don't like the idea of fish farming that much. But at the same time, it keeps growing. It's the fastest growing food system in the world. So either we can sort of turn a blind eye to it and say, I only eat wild fish, let other people eat the farmed fish. Or we can kind of confront it and see, well, where are the key gaps where we could fill in with farmed fish? What and which fish could fill those gaps?
So one more just question on this, and then we'll move towards the conclusion. But
What
about just catch shares? Because it's a sort of bandied about almost as a kind of a magic bullet phrase, right, which is going to solve everything. But every time I turn around, you know, I'll see some congressman with a significant constituency of fishermen like Barney Frank sort of complaining about the shares are set too low for his constituents. And so now we need to, as he said recently, go after Jane Lubchenco, the founder, the head of NOAA over this.
You know, the thing with fisheries is that anytime there's any kind of success, people like are so desperate for any kind of success that they tend to try and, you know, apply one model everywhere. The biggest problem I've seen with catch shares is that it can lead to a kind of a monopolization situation, you know, like you've got with Alaska pollock, where there are just a few very, very powerful players running the show. And long term, I'd rather see, you know, smaller catch shares but more fishermen out there. And I guess you need to have some sort of institution that keeps, you know, limits a certain kind of monopoly process that could happen with catch shares. So I think that's been my biggest criticism of them as, you know, moving forward.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Paul. We really appreciate you taking some time out for this interview.
No, those are great questions, Andrew. It's nice to speak to, you know, somebody from science.
Sure. And I'll just tell to readers and listeners out there that if you want to learn more about Paul's book, go to www.forfish.org.
Thanks, Andrew.